week doing this, knowing that the words of white Englishmen would mean nothing to her, that she could not read them, knowing that she would have to come to him to find out what the leaves said. He would think about it every night, the girl bringing her bundle of leaves to him so that he might recite a dream or a night thought to her. Instead, she went to Edward. It was Edward who read the lines to her, and afterward, it was Edward who told her that the leaves were Yao's doing. "He likes you, you know," Edward said. "Maybe he will one day ask you to marry him." But the girl shook her head, clucked her tongue in distaste. "If I marry him, my children will be ugly," she declared. That night, lying next to Edward in his room, Yao listened as his best friend told him that he had explained to the girl that you could not inherit a scar. Now, nearing his 50th birthday, Yao no longer knew if he believed this was true. The semester passed. In June, Kwame Nkrumah, a political leader from Nkrofwa, started the Convention People's Party, and Edward joined soon thereafter. "Independence is coming, my brother," he was fond of saying to Yao on the nights when Yao still joined him and his wife for dinner. This happened less and less. Mrs. Boahen was expecting her fifth child, and the pregnancy was difficult. So difficult that the Boahens stopped entertaining. First just the other teachers and town friends that they had acquired. But then Yao, too, noticed that even his welcome began to wear. And so Yao got a house girl. He had been resistant to having other people in his house for as long as he could remember. He could cook a few dishes for himself competently enough. He could fetch his own water and wash his own clothes. He did not keep his house as neat as he had been forced to keep his room in school. But none of this bothered him. He preferred the clutter and the plain meals if it meant he would not have to have another person in his house looking at him. "That's ridiculous," Edward said. "You're a teacher. People stare at you all day." But for Yao that was different. At the front of the classroom, he was not himself. He was a performer in the tradition of village dancers and storytellers. At home, he was who he really was, shy and lonely, angry and embarrassed. He did not want anyone to see him there. Edward examined all the candidates himself, and in the end, Yao ended up with Esther and a hunter from right there in Takerde. Esther was a plain girl, maybe even ugly. Her eyes were too large for her head, and her head too large for her body. On the first day of work, Yao showed her to her room at the back of the house and told her that he spent most of his time writing. He asked her not to disturb him, and then went back out to sit at his desk. The book was getting unruly. The Gold Coast Independence Movement's political leaders, the Big Six, had all come back from school in America and England, and as far as Yao could tell, they were all like Edward, patient but forceful, confident that independence would indeed come. Yao had been reading more and more about the black people of America's movement toward freedom, and he was attracted to the rage that lit each sentence of their books on fire. He wanted that from his book, an academic rage. All he could seem to muster was a long-winded whine. "Excuse me, sir." Yao looked up from his book. Esther was standing in front of him with the long handmade broom she had insisted on bringing with her, even though Yao told her that his house had many brooms. "You don't have to speak in English," Yao said. "Yes, sir, but my sister say you are teacher, so I must speak English. She looked terrified, her shoulders hunched and her hands gripping the broom so tightly that Yao could see the area around her knuckles begin to stretch and redden. He wished he could cover his face, put the young woman at ease. "You understand tree," Yao said in his mother tongue, and Esther nodded. "Then speak freely. We hear enough English as it is." It was like he had opened a gate. Her body began to slip into an easy stance, and Yao realized that it was not his scar that had terrified her, but rather the problem of language, a marker of her education, her class, compared with his. She had been terrified that for the teacher of the white book, she would have to speak the white tongue. Now released from English, Esther smiled more brightly than Yao had seen anyone smile in ages. He could see the large, proud gap that stood like a doorway between her two front teeth, and he found himself training his gaze through that door as though he could see all the way down into her throat, her gut, the home of her very soul. "Sir, I have finished cleaning the bedroom. You have a lot of books in there, did you know? Do you read all of those books? Can you read English? Sir, where do you keep the palm oil? I could not find it in the kitchen. It is a nice kitchen. What will you have for dinner? Should I go to the market? What are you writing?" Did she breathe? If she had, Yao didn't hear it. He shuffled the pages of his book and set it aside as he thought about what to say next. "Make whatever you want for dinner. I don't care what." She nodded, not dissatisfied, it seemed, with the fact that he had answered only one of her questions. "I'll make goat pepper soup," she said, her eyes cast downward, moving this way and that, as though searching the floor for any thought she might have dropped there. "I will go to market today." She looked up at him. "Would you like to go to market with me?" Suddenly, Yao was angry or nervous. He couldn't quite tell which, and so he chose to respond with anger. "Why should I go to market with you? Don't you work for me?" he shouted. Her mouth closed, the portal to her soul hidden. She cocked her head to the side and stared at him as though it was just then occurring to her that he had a face, that his face had a scar. She studied it for 1 second more, and then smiled again. "I thought you might want a break from your writing. My sister said teachers are very serious, because they do all their work in their minds, and so sometimes they have to be reminded that they must use their bodies. Will you not use your body if you walk to the market?" Now it was Yao's turn to smile. Esther laughed, her whole wide mouth open, and suddenly Yao had the strange urge to reach in and pull something of that happiness out for himself, so that he might keep it with him always. They went to the market. Fat women with babies at their breasts sold soup, corn, yams, meat. Men and young boys stood bartering with each other. Some sold food. Others sold carvings and wooden drums. Yao stopped by the stand of a boy who looked to be about 13, who was using a slim knife to carve symbols into a drum. The boy's father stood careful watch beside him. Yao recognized the man from last year's Kundum. He was one of the best drummers Yao had ever seen, and as the man stared at his son, Yao could see that he wanted the boy to be even better. "You like to drum?" Esther asked. Yao didn't realize she had been watching him. It was so rare that he had to be concerned with other people. He hadn't been angry, after all. Just nervous. Me? No, no. I never learned how. She nodded. She led the freshly purchased, roped goat behind her, and at times while they walked, the animal grew obstinate, digging its hooves into the ground and nudging its head against the air, its horns reflecting light. She tugged it forcefully, and it bleated, perhaps at her, though perhaps it would have done so anyway. Yao realized that he should say something. He cleared his throat and looked at her, but his words stuck. She smiled at him. "I make a very good goat pepper soup," she said. "Is that right?" "Yes. So good you would think your mother made it." "Where is your mother?" she asked in a breathless way. The goat stood still, screamed. Esther wrapped the rope once more around her wrist and tugged. It occurred to Yao that he should offer to walk the goat for her, but he didn't. "My mother lives in Ejiso. I haven't seen her since the day I turned 6. He paused. "She did this to me." He pointed to the scar, angled his body so that she could see it more clearly. Esther stopped walking, and so Yao stopped too. She looked at him, and for a second he worried that she would reach out and try to touch him. But she didn't. Instead, she said, "You're very angry." "Yes," he said. It was something he rarely admitted to himself, let alone to anyone else. The longer he looked at himself in a mirror, the longer he lived alone, the longer the country he loved stayed under colonial rule, the angrier he became. And the nebulous, mysterious object of his anger was his mother, a woman whose face he could barely remember, but a face reflected in his own scar. "Anger doesn't suit you," Esther said. She gave the goat one more good tug, and Yao listened to it bleat as the two of them walked ahead of him. He was in love with her. 5 years passed before he realized it, though perhaps he knew on that first day. It was summer, and the insistent fog of heat was upon them, so ever-present it felt like a low hum, a heat you could hear. Yao didn't have to teach summer term, and so he had hours, whole days, to sit and read and write. Instead, he watched Esther clean from his spot at the desk. He pretended to be annoyed when she rolled off her list of endless questions. But since that first day, he always answered them all, each and every one. When it was not raining, he would sit outside under the shade of the big bushy mango tree while she drew water from the well. She carried it back to the house in 2 buckets, and the swollen muscles of her arms would flex, and the sheen of sweat would appear on them. And when she passed him, she would smile, the gap so lovely it made him want to cry. Everything made him want to cry. He could see the differences between them as long ravines, impossible to cross. He was old. She was young. He was educated. She was not. He was scarred. She was whole. Each difference split the ravine wider and wider still. There was no way. And so, he didn't speak. In the evening she would ask him what he wanted for dinner, what he was working on, whether he had heard any updates about the independence movement, whether he was still considering traveling for more education. He said what needed to be said, nothing more. "The banku is too sticky today," she said while they ate one night. In the beginning, she had insisted on taking her meals separately from him, saying that it wouldn't be proper for them to eat together, which was true enough. But the thought of her alone in her room with nowhere for all of our questions to go seemed to him to be the worst option. So now, this, and every night, she ate across from him at his small wooden table. "It's good," he said. He smiled. He wished he were a beautiful man, with skin as smooth as clay. But he was not the kind of man who could win a woman just with his presence. He would have to do something. "No, I've made much better in the past. It's okay. You don't have to eat it if you don't like it. I'll make something else for you. Would you like soup?" She was starting to pick up his plate, so he held it down. "This is good," he said again, more forcefully. He wondered what he should do to win her. For the past 5 years she had been drawing him more and more out of himself, asking him questions about his schooling, about Edward, about the past. "Would you like to go to Ejisa with me?" Yao asked. "To visit my mother." As soon as he said it, he regretted it. For years, Esther had been nudging him to go, but he either deflected or ignored her. Now his love had made him desperate. He didn't even know if the crazy woman of Ejiso was still alive. Esther looked uncertain. "You want me to go?" "In case I need someone to cook for me as I travel," he said hurriedly, trying to cover his tracks. She considered this for a moment, and then she nodded. For the first time since he had met her, she had no further questions. There were 206 kilometers between Takrida and Ejiso. Yao knew, because he could feel each kilometer as though it were a stone lodged in his throat. 206 stones collected in his mouth, so that he could not speak. Even when Esther asked him a question, like how much longer were they to travel, how would he explain her presence to the townspeople, what would he say to his mother when he saw her, the stones blocked his words from passing. Eventually, Esther too grew silent. He remembered so little of Ejiso, so he could not say if things had changed. When they reached the town, they were greeted first by a sweltering heat, the sun's rays stretched out like a cat after a nap. There were only a few people standing about the square that day, but the ones who were there stared freely, shocked at the sight either of the car or of the strangers. "What are they looking at?" Esther whispered miserably. She was worried about herself, that people would think it improper for them to be traveling together, unmarried. She had not said this to him yet, but he could see it in the way she lowered her eyes and walked behind him. Before long, a little boy no older than 4, holding the long train of his mother's wrapper, pointed at Yao with his tiny index finger.
"Look, Mama. His face. His face."
The boy's father, who stood on the other side of him, snatched his hand away. "Stop that nonsense," he said. But then he looked more closely along the line the boy's finger had drawn. He approached Yao and Esther where they stood, uncertain, holding one bag each.
"Yao?"
he asked. Yao dropped his bag to the ground and walked closer to the man.
"Yes," he said. "I'm afraid I don't remember you."
He held his hand above his brows to shield his eyes from the sun, but was soon extending it again to shake the man's hand.
"They call me Kofi Poku," the man said, shaking back. "I was about 10 when you left. This is my wife Gifty, and my son, Henry."
Yao shook hands all around and then turned toward Esther.
This is Esther, he said,
and Esther too shook hands all around.
"You must be here to see Crazy Woman," Kofi Poku said before realizing his mistake. He covered his mouth. I'm so sorry. I mean, Ma Akuya. Yao could tell from the way his eyes searched and his mouth slowed that Kofi Poku had not had to call his mother by her name in years. Perhaps ever. As far as Yao knew, the crazy woman of Ejiso could have earned her title well before his birth. Please don't worry, Yao said. We are here to see my mother, yes. Just then, Kofi Poku's wife leaned into his ear to whisper something, and the man's eyebrows lifted, face brightening. When he spoke, it was as though the idea had been his all along. You and your wife must be very tired from your journey. Please, my wife and I would like you to stay with us. We will make you dinner. Yao started to shake his head, but Kofi Poku waved his hand, as though trying to counteract Yao's shake with his own. I insist. Besides, your mother keeps odd hours. It would not be good for you to go to her today. Wait until tomorrow evening. We will send someone to tell her you are coming. How could they refuse? Yao and Esther had planned on going straight to Akuya's house to stay. But instead, they walked the short miles distance from the town square to the Poku house. When they got there, Kofi Poku's other children, three daughters and one son, were beginning dinner. One of the girls, the tallest and most slender, sat before a great big mortar. The boy held the pestle, which was nearly twice his height. He held it straight up, and then would send it crashing down just as the girl's hand finished turning the fufu in the mortar, barely escaping the impact. "Hello, my children," Kofi Poku called, and all of the children stopped what they were doing and stood, so that they could greet their parents. But when they saw Yao, their voices hushed and their eyes widened. The one who looked like the youngest girl, with two puffs of her hair on either side of her head, pulled on her brother's pants leg. "Crazy woman, son," she whispered. Yet still, all could hear. And Yao knew for certain now that his story had become legend in his hometown. Everyone stood there, embarrassed for a minute, and then Esther, with her large and muscular arms, snatched the pestle from the older boy and quickly struck the fufu in the mortar before anyone had time to think or react. The ball of fufu flattened, and the fufu stick fell with a thud against the clay earth. "Enough!" Esther shouted once they had all turned to stare at her. "Has this man not suffered enough that he should come home to this?" she asked. "Please excuse my child," Mrs. Poku said, using her voice to speak instead of her husband's for the first time since they'd met her. "It's just that they have heard these stories. They will not make the mistake again." She turned, allowed her gaze to rest on each of the five children, even the toddler at her feet, and quickly, without any need for further explanation, they understood. Kofi Poku cleared his throat and motioned for the two of them to follow him to their seats. As they did, Yao whispered, "Thank you," and Esther shrugged. "Let them think that I am the crazy one," Esther said. They sat down to their meal. The kids served them, frightened, but kind. Kofi Poku and his wife told them what to expect from Yao's mother. "She lives with only a house girl in that place your father built for her on the edge of town. She rarely goes out anymore, though sometimes you can see her outside tending to her garden. She has a lovely garden. My wife often goes there to admire the flowers that grow there." "Does she speak when you see her?" Yao asked Mrs. Poku. The woman shook her head. No, but she has always been kind to me. She even gives me some flowers to take home. I put them in the girls' hair before we go to church, and I think it will bring them good marriages.
Don't worry, Kofi Poku said. I'm sure she will know you. Her heart will know you. His wife and Esther both nodded, and Yao looked away. It was dark in the courtyard, but the heat had not lessened, only transformed, buzzing with mosquitoes and humming with gnats. Yao and Esther finished their food. They said thank you. They were taken to their room, where Esther insisted on the floor, while Yao got the mattress, a tough, springy thing that fought his back. Like that, and there, they slept. They spent the morning preparing, walking around Ejiso, and eating many times. They had been told that Yao's mother rarely slept and seemed to prefer evenings to mornings, and so they bided their time. Esther had left Takrady only once in her life, and Yao loved seeing the wonder in her eyes as they took in the strangeness of this new town. Everyone thought they were married. Yao did not correct them, and, to his delight, Esther did not correct them either, though Yao wondered if this was more a factor of her politeness than her desire. He was too afraid to ask. Soon the sky began to darken, and with each new shade, Yao's stomach began to tighten. Esther kept glancing at him carefully, taking in his face as though it held instructions for how she herself should feel. "Don't be afraid," she said. Since they'd met 5 years before, Esther had been the one to encourage his homecoming. She said it had something to do with forgiveness. But Yao wasn't certain that he believed in forgiveness. He heard the word most on the few days he went to the white man's church with Edward and Mrs. Boahin, and sometimes with Esther, and so it had begun to seem to him like a word the white man brought with them when they first came to Africa, a trick their Christians had learned and spoke loudly and freely about to the people of the Gold Coast. Forgiveness, they shouted, all the while committing their wrongs. When he was younger, Yao wondered why they did not preach that the people should avoid wrongdoing altogether. But the older he got, the better he understood. Forgiveness was an act done after the fact, a piece of the bad deed's future. And if you point the people's eye to the future, they might not see what is being done to hurt them in the present. When it was finally evening, Kofi Poku led Yao and Esther to Yao's mother's house on the outskirts of town. Yao knew it immediately from the lush things that grew in her garden. Colors that Yao had never seen before bloomed off of long green stalks that rustled from the wind or the small creatures that moved beneath them.
"This is where I leave you," Kofi Poku said. They had not even reached the door yet. For any other family, in this and many other towns, it would have been considered rude for a townsperson to be so close to a person's house and not greet the master of the house. But Yao could see the discomfort in the man's face, and he waved to him and thanked him again while he made his way off. The door to the house was open, but still Yao knocked twice, Esther standing behind him. "Hello?" a confused voice called. A woman, who looked older than Yao, carrying a clay bowl, rounded the corner. When she saw Yao, saw his scar, she gasped, and the bowl fell to the ground, shattering, scattering pieces of red clay from the door all the way into the garden. Tiny pieces of clay that they would never find, that would be absorbed into that earth from which they came. The woman was shouting, We thank God for all of his mercies. We thank him that he is alive. Our God, he does not sleep. Oh!
She danced around the room.
Old lady, God has brought you your son. Old lady, God has brought you your son, so you do not have to go to Asamando without seeing him. Old woman, come and see, she yelled.
Behind him, Yao could hear Esther clapping her hands together in her own mini praise. He didn't turn, but he knew she was smiling brightly, and the warmth of that thought emboldened him to step a bit further into the room.
"Does she not hear me?"
the woman mumbled to herself, turning sharply toward the bedroom. Yao kept moving, at first following the woman, but then continuing straight until he reached the living room. His mother sat in the corner.
"So you have returned home at last," she said, smiling.
If he had not already known that the woman in this house was his mother, he would not have known by looking at her. Yao was 55, which meant she would be 76, but she seemed younger. Her eyes had the unburdened look of the young, and her smile was generous, yet wise. When she stood up, her back was straight, her bones not yet hunched from the weight of each year. When she walked toward him, her limbs were fluid, not stiff, the joints never halting. And when she touched him, when she took his hands in her own, her scarred and ruined hands, when she rubbed the backs of his hands with her crooked thumbs, he felt how soft her own burns were, how very, very soft.
The sun has come home at last. The dreams, they do not fail to come true. They do not fail.
She continued to hold his hands. In the entryway, the servant woman cleared her throat. Yao turned to find her and Esther standing there, grinning at them.
"Old woman, we will make dinner,"
the woman shouted. Yao wondered if her voice was always this loud, or if the volume was for him. "Please, don't go to any trouble," he begged.
"Eh? The son comes home after all these years, does the mother not kill a goat?"
She sucked her teeth on the way out of the door.
"And you?"
Yao asked Esther.
"Who will boil the yam while the woman kills the goat?" she asked, her voice mischievous.
Yao watched them go, and for the first time, he grew nervous. Suddenly he felt something he had not felt in a long, long time.
"What are you doing?"
he shouted, for his mother had put her hand on his scar, running her fingers along the ruined skin that he alone had touched for nearly half a century. She continued, undeterred by the anger in his voice. She took her own burned fingers from the lost eyebrow to the raised cheek to the scarred chin. She touched all of it, and only once she had finished did Yao begin to weep. She pulled him down to the ground with her, pulled his head to her bosom, and began to chant softly,
"My son, oh, my son. My son, oh, my son."
The two stayed like this for a long while, and after Yao had cried more tears than he had ever cried before, after his mother had finished calling his name out into the world, he peeled himself away so that he could look at her.
"Tell me the story of how I got my scar," he said.
She sighed.
"How can I tell you the story of your scar without first telling you the story of my dreams? And how do I talk about my dreams without talking about my family, our family?" Yao waited. His mother got off the ground and motioned for him to do the same. She pointed to a chair on one side of the room, and she took the chair on the other. She looked at the wall behind his head. "Before you were born, I began to have bad dreams. The dreams started out the same. A woman made of fire would visit me. In her arms, she carried her two fire children. But then the children would disappear and the woman would turn her anger toward me. Even before the dreams began, I was not well. My mother died at the hands of the missionary at the school in Kumasi. Do you know it?" Yao shook his head. He had never heard this before, and even if he had, he would have been too young to remember it. "The missionary raised me. My only friend was a fetish priest. I was always a sad girl because I did not know that there was any other way to be. When I married your father, I thought I could be happy. And when I had your sisters..." Here, her voice caught, but she lifted her shoulders, began again. "When I had your sisters, I thought I was happy. But then I saw a white man burn in the square in Ejiso, and the dreams began. Then the war began, and the dreams grew worse. Your father came back without a leg, and the dreams grew worse. I had you, and the sadness did not stop. I tried to fight sleep, but I am human, and sleep is not. We were not equally matched. In my sleep one night, I set the hut on fire. They say your father could only save one, you. But that is not entirely true. He also saved me from the townspeople. For many years, I wished that he had not. They only let me see you so that I could feed you. Then they sent you away and would not tell me where. I have lived here, in this house with Kukuya, since that day." As if summoned, Kukuya, the old servant, came in with wine. She served Yao first and then his mother. But the woman refused. Kukuya left as quietly as she had entered. Yao drank from the wine as though it were water. When the cup lay empty at his feet, he turned his attention back to his mother. She took a deep breath and began again. "The dreams didn't stop, not after the fire, not even to this day. I started to get to know the fire woman. Sometimes, as on the night of the fire, she would take me to the ocean in Cape Coast. Sometimes she would take me to a cocoa farm. Sometimes to Kumasi. I didn't know why. I wanted answers, so I went back to the missionary school to ask about my mother's family. The missionary told me that he had burned all of my mother's belongings. But he lied. He had kept one thing for himself. His mother pulled a fierce necklace from her neck then, and held it out to Yao. It glowed black in her hand. He touched it, felt the smoothness of it. I took the necklace to the fetish man's son so that I could make offerings to our ancestors so that they might stop punishing me. Kukuya was maybe 14 at this time. When we did the ritual, the fetish man's son stopped. He dropped the necklace very suddenly and said, 'Do you know there is evil in your lineage?' I thought he was talking about me, the things I had done, and so I nodded. But then he said, 'This thing you are carrying, it does not belong to you.' When I told him about my dreams, he said that the fire woman was an ancestor come back to visit me. He said that the black stone had belonged to her, and that was why it grew hot in his hand. He said that if I listened to her, she would tell me where I came from. He said, I should be glad that I was chosen. Yao grew angry again. Why should she be glad she was chosen if she was now a ruined woman and he a ruined man? How could she be content with this life? His mother must have sensed his anger. Old woman that she was, she went to him and knelt before him. Yao knew she was crying by the wetness of his feet. She looked up at him and said, I can't forgive myself for what I've done. I won't. But when I listened to the fire woman's stories, I began to see that the fetish priest was right. There is evil in our lineage. There are people who have done wrong because they could not see the result of the wrong. They did not have these burned hands as warning. She held her hands out to him, and he looked at them carefully. He recognized her skin in his own. What I know now, my son. Evil begets evil. It grows. It transmutes, so that sometimes you cannot see that the evil in the world began as the evil in your own home. I'm sorry you have suffered. I'm sorry for the way your suffering casts a shadow over your life, over the woman you have yet to marry, the children you have yet to have. Yao looked at her surprised, but she simply smiled. When someone does wrong, whether it is you or me, whether it is mother or father, whether it is the Gold Coast man or the white man, it is like a fisherman casting a net into the water. He keeps only the one or two fish that he needs to feed himself, and puts the rest in the water, thinking that their lives will go back to normal. No one forgets that they were once captive, even if they are now free. But still, Yao, you have to let yourself be free. Yao took his mother up from the ground and into his arms while she kept chanting, Be free, Yao. Be free. He hugged her, surprised by how light she was. Soon Esther and Kukuiya came in carrying pot after pot of food. They served Yao and his mother well into the night. They ate until the sun came up.
Sunny. Jail gave Sunny time to read. He used the hours before his mother bailed him out to thumb through The Souls of Black Folk. He'd read it four times already, and he still wasn't tired of it. It reaffirmed for him the purpose of his being there, on an iron bench, in an iron cell. Every time he felt the futility of his work for the NAACP, he'd finger the well-worn pages of that book, and it would strengthen his resolve. "Ain't you tired of this?" Willie said when she stormed through the doors of the police station. She was holding her tattered coat in one hand and a broom in the other. She had been cleaning houses on the Upper East Side for as long as Sunny could remember, and she didn't trust the brooms white people kept around, and so she always brought her own, carrying it from subway station, to street, to house. When he was a teenager, that broom used to embarrass Sunny no end, seeing his mother lug it around like it was a cross. If she held it on the day she called his name while he played with his friends on the basketball court, he would deny her like Peter.
Carson!
She'd yell. And as he answered her with silence, he would think that he was justified in not responding, for he'd long since gone by Sunny.
He'd let her call out Carson a few times more before he finally said, "What?" He knew he'd pay for it when he got back home. He knew his mother would bring out her Bible and start praise shouting over him. But he did it anyway. Sonny took up the souls of black folk while the officer opened the door. He nodded at the other man who'd been arrested during the march and brushed past his mother. "How many times they gotta throw you in jail, huh?" Willie called after him, but Sonny kept walking. It wasn't like he hadn't asked himself the same thing 100 times or more. How many times could he pick himself up off the dirty floor of a jail cell? How many hours could he spend marching? How many bruises could he collect from the police? How many letters to the mayor, governor, president could he send? How many more days would it take to get something to change? And when it changed, would it change? Would America be any different, or would it be mostly the same? For Sonny, the problem with America wasn't segregation, but the fact that you could not, in fact, segregate. Sonny had been trying to get away from white people for as long as he could remember. But big as this country was, there was nowhere to go. Not even Harlem, where white folks owned just about everything an eye could see or a hand could touch. What Sonny wanted was Africa. Marcus Garvey had been onto something. Liberia and Sierra Leone, those two efforts had been a good thing. In theory, at least. The problem was that in practice, things didn't work the way they did in theory. The practice of segregation still meant that Sonny had to see white people sitting at the front of every bus he took. That he got called boy by every other snot-nosed white kid in sight. The practice of segregation meant that he had to feel his separateness as inequality, and that was what he could not take.
"Carson, I'm talking to you," Willie shouted.
Sonny knew he was never too old for a knock on his head, and so he turned to face his mother.
"What?"
She gave him a hard look, and he gave it right back. For the first few years of his life, it had just been him and Willie. Try as hard as he might, Sonny could never conjure up a picture of his father, and he still hadn't forgiven his mother for that.
"You's a hard-headed fool," Willie said, pushing past him now.
"You need to stop spending time in jail and start spending it with your kids. That's what you need to do." She muttered the last part so that Sonny could barely hear her, but he would have known what she said even if she hadn't said it. He was mad at her because he didn't have a father, and she was mad at him because he'd become as absent as his own. Sonny was on the housing team at the NAACP. Once a week, he and the other men and women on the team went around to all the different neighborhoods in Harlem to ask people how they were faring.
"We got so many roaches and rats, we got to keep the toothbrushes in the fridge," one mother said.
It was the last Friday of the month, and Sonny was still nursing Thursday night's headache.
"Mm-hmm,"
he said to the woman, sweeping a hand over his brow, as though he could mop up a bit of the pain that pulsed there. While she talked, Sonny pretended to take notes in his notepad. But it was the same thing he'd heard at the last place, and the one before that. In fact, Sonny could have not gone to a single apartment, and still he would have known what the tenants would say. He and Willie, and his sister Josephine, had lived in conditions like these, and much worse. He could remember with clarity a time when his mother's second husband, Eli, left and took the month's rent with him. Sonny had held baby Josephine in his arms while they all went from block to block, begging anyone who would listen to take them in. They'd ended up in an apartment that had 40 people living in it, including a sick old woman who'd lost control of her bowels. Every night the woman would sit in a corner, shaking and crying, and filling her shoes with her own shit. Then the rats would come to eat it. Once, when his mother was desperate, She'd taken them to stay in one of the Manhattan apartments that she cleaned while that family was on vacation. The apartment had 6 bedrooms for only 2 people. Sonny didn't know what to do with himself with all that space. He spent the whole day in the smallest room, too scared to touch anything, knowing that his mother would have to dust off his fingerprints if he was to leave them.
"Can you help, mister?"
a boy said. Sonny dropped his notepad down and looked at him. He was small, but something about the look in his eyes told Sonny that he was older than he looked, maybe 14 or 15. The boy came up to the woman and put a hand on her shoulder. He stared at Sonny longer, and so Sonny had time to study his eyes. They were the biggest eyes Sonny had ever seen on a man or a woman, with eyelashes like the long, glamorous legs of a terrifying spider. "You can't, can you?" the boy said. He blinked twice quickly, and watching his spider-leg lashes entangle, Sonny was suddenly filled with fear. "You can't do a single thing, can you?" the boy continued. Sonny didn't know what to say. He just knew he had to get out of there. The boy's voice rang in Sonny's head for the rest of that week, month, year. He'd asked to be moved off the housing team, lest he see him again. "You can't do a single thing, can you?" Sonny was arrested at another march, and then another, and then another. After the third arrest, when Sonny was already handcuffed, one of the police officers punched him in the face. As his eyes started to swell shut, Sonny puckered his lips as if to spit, but the officer just looked him in his one good eye, shook his head, and said, "Do that, and you'll die today." His mother saw his face and started to weep. "I didn't leave Alabama for this," she said. Sonny was supposed to go to her house for Sunday dinner, but he skipped it. He skipped work that week, too. "You can't do a single thing, can you?" Reverend George Lee of Mississippi was fatally shot while trying to register to vote. Rosa Jordan was shot while riding a newly desegregated bus in Montgomery, Alabama. She was pregnant. "You can't do a single thing, can you?" Sonny kept skipping out on work. Instead, he sat on a bench next to the man who swept the barbershops on 7th. Sonny didn't know the man's name. He just liked to sit and talk to him. Maybe it was the fact that the man held a broom like his mother did. He could talk to him in a way he'd never been able to talk to her. "What do you do when you feel helpless?" Sonny asked. The man took a long drag off his Newport. "This helps," he said, waving the cigarette in the air. He pulled out a small glassine bag from his pocket and placed it in Sonny's hand. "When that don't help, this do," he said. Sonny fingered the dope for a while. He didn't speak, and soon the barber sweep took up his broom and left. Sonny sat on that bench for nearly an hour, just running that small bag from finger to finger, thinking about it. He thought about it as he walked the 10 blocks home. He thought about it as he fried an egg for dinner. If nothing he did changed anything, then maybe he was the one who would have to make a change. By mid-afternoon the next day, Sonny had stopped thinking about it. He called up the NAACP and quit his job before flushing the bag down the toilet. "What are you going to do for money?" Josephine asked Sonny. He couldn't keep his apartment now that he didn't have an income, so he was staying at his mother's house until he could figure things out. Willie stood over the sink, washing dishes and humming her gospel tunes. She hummed loudest when she wanted to appear as though she wasn't listening in. "I'll figure something out. I always do, don't I?" His voice was a dare, and Josephine didn't accept, leaning back into her seat and becoming suddenly silent.
His mother hummed a little louder and started to dry the dishes in her hands.
"Let me help you with that, Mama," Sonny said, hopping up.
Immediately, she started in on him so that he knew that she had been listening.
"Lucille came by here yesterday asking for you," Willie said.
Sonny grunted.
"Seemed like maybe you should give the girl a call."
"She know how to find me when she want to."
"What about Angela or Rhonda? They know how to find you too? Seem like they only know how to get to my house on days you ain't here."
Sonny grunted again.
"You don't gotta give 'em nothing, Mama," he said.
His mother snorted. She stopped humming and started singing instead. Sonny knew he had to get out of the apartment, and fast. If his women were after him, and his mama was singing gospel, he had better find himself a place to be. He went to see his friend Muhammad about a job.
"You should join the Nation of Islam, man," Muhammad said. "Forget the NAACP. They ain't doing shit."
Sonny accepted a glass of water from Muhammad's eldest daughter. He shrugged at his friend.
They'd had this conversation before. Sonny couldn't join the Nation of Islam as long as his mother was a devout Christian woman. He would never hear the end of it. Besides, his days of sitting in the back of his mother's church had not left him immune to ideas about the wrath of God. It was not the kind of thing you wanted to attract.
"Islam ain't getting shit done neither," he said.
His friend Muhammad used to be named Johnny. They'd met shooting hoops in courts all around Harlem when they were boys, and they'd kept up their friendship, even as their basketball days ended and their midsections grew. When they'd met, Sonny had still gone by Carson, but on the court, he liked the quickness, the ease of Sonny, and so he'd adopted that name as his own. His mother hated it. He knew it was because his father used to call him that. But Sonny didn't know a thing about his father, and there was no sentimental pull to the name for him other than the sound of the other kids saying, "Yeah, son. Yeah, Sonny," when he sunk one.
"It's dry out there, Sonny," Muhammad said.
"You gotta know something. Anything, man."
"How much school you had?" Muhammad asked.
"Couple years," Sonny said. In truth, he couldn't remember finishing one year in any one place. So much had he skipped school, moved around, gotten kicked out. One year, out of sheer desperation, his mother had tried to get him into one of the fancy white schools in Manhattan. She'd marched into the office wearing glasses and carrying her best pen. While Sonny looked at the pristine building, clean and shiny, with smartly dressed white children entering and exiting as calmly as can be, he thought about his own schools, the ones in Harlem that had the ceiling falling in and smelled of some unnameable funk, and he was surprised that both things could even be called schools. Sonny could remember how the white school officials had asked his mother if she wanted some coffee. They told her that it just wasn't possible for him to go there. It just wasn't possible. Sonny could remember Willie squeezing his hand with one of hers as they walked back to Harlem, wiping away tears with the other. To comfort her, Sonny said he didn't mind his schools because he never went, and Willie said the fact that he never went was what was wrong with them.
"That ain't enough for the one thing I heard about," Muhammad said.
"I gotta work, Muhammad. I got to."
Muhammad nodded slowly, thinking, and the next week he gave Sonny the number of a man who had left the Nation and now owned a bar. 2 weeks later, Sonny was taking drink orders at Jazz Mine, the new jazz club in East Harlem. Sonny moved his things out of his mother's house the night he found out he got the job. He didn't tell her where he was working, because he already knew she didn't approve of jazz or any other kind of secular music. She sang for the church, used her voice for Christ, and that was it. Sonny had asked her once if she had ever wanted to be famous like Billie Holiday, singing so sweet that even white people had to pay attention. But his mother just looked away and told him to be careful of that kind of life. Jasmine was too new to attract the big-time clients and players.